Cheating death, that's what we're talking about. And when death really isn't death. And doctor, welcome back. As a doctor, you explained already earlier that younger you actually participated with your mom in some
Seances.
trances. Yes. And so as a doctor then, with that background, you must have had an eye out for the paranormal. Did you ever have an experience yourself that you would put in that category or that you can't explain rationally?
Oh, you know, in medicine, you see strange things, and you're always dealing with people who are dying, have died, are about to die. And I worked in a hospital in Hawaii. You know, Hawaii is kind of it's a very spiritual place. People seem
Oh, yes.
in tune with the afterlife and
No
with
doubt.
ghosts and things because there are just a lot of people there who believe in this stuff. I worked in a hospital that had it was a Catholic hospital. And one of the nurses there was also a nun. And it was very creepy. Every so often, she would walk into somebody's room and bless them and walk out.
Yes.
And I asked somebody, well, how come she did it with that patient? And they said, when she gives that blessing, she knows they're going to die. This woman, this nurse knew. And I'm not talking she was an angel of death. It's just that she had this ability to know somebody was going to come in and was not going to make it. And she would make sure they got their blessing ahead of time. Now, part of it is that, yeah, you see somebody and you think, yeah, they're pretty sick. Of course they're going to die. But she did it a couple times to people who were perfectly healthy. She just had this sense. I asked her once, and she said, I can smell it. I can smell when somebody's going to die.
Wow.
And she couldn't explain. She just says they smell like death. There was a room on one particular ward in that same hospital. They tried never to put patients in that room. That room pretty much stayed empty until they got loaded to the gills, and they had to put people in there.
Yes.
And the reason was the room was haunted, according to the nurses. Again and again, they would have patients who were in that room who would wake up, would call, you know, ring the call button and say, who is that person standing over my bed? And the person that they would see would be a man in a hospital gown. That was a ghost. I never saw the ghost. I kept going in there looking for the ghost and never saw it. But it was
Still,
so common.
when you have experiences like that, with the one you just described with the nurse, how can you not be spiritual to some degree? In other words, have enough doubts that you're not just an agnostic, but kind of a spiritual person. It almost sounds as though you are in some ways. I mean, you tell these stories, and it has to have affected you.
I'm curious. I'm agnostic about spirit, about ghost stories as well. As you know, I'm waiting. I'm waiting to see one myself. I'm open-minded enough to know that you know, there are things out there we cannot explain. And that the idea of the haunted room in which patients again and again seem to have experienced the same thing.
Yes.
Then the other, you know, on the other hand, what if they're getting checked in and the nurse happens to say, "Oh, you're in the haunted room." You know, that's going to affect what they
Suggestion.
dream about.
Yeah, suggestion, I'm sure. But
Yeah.
you wouldn't think that a nurse or anybody else in the hospital would admit to any patient they're going into a haunted room.
You would think not, but you never know. I mean, there may be a volunteer comes in, and it's just hard to know why this particular thing happens. It may be that a lot of patients wake up with hallucinations of seeing something in the room because they're in an unfamiliar room, and it just. The nurses just happened to remember that it was this particular room that happened more than once, and it became legend, and it became, you know, embellished over the years.
All right, maybe. But going back again to your first story and that sister,
Yes.
that has to affect you.
Well, you know, again, there could be a logical explanation for that as well. Is it that she is just a very, very good clinician, and you know that she has an instinct? There is something that she is picking up on. Maybe she is able to see that they're a little paler than usual, or there is something about them that looks preterminal. And the other thing that's interesting is that people who have cancer do give off a certain odor. This is what I've heard that dogs are actually used sometimes,
Huh.
because they're such, you know, they have such acute senses of a scent that they can, and I don't know what the scientific investigation on this is, but I have heard stories that sometimes dogs can detect when somebody is suffering from cancer.
Well,
Is it possible that this particular nurse had a, you know, an advanced olfactory system?
Possibly. Certainly, it has been proven that dogs know when their owners are coming home. They did this experiment that ran on one of the primetime news shows where they kept cameras on dogs. Then they'd have the owner start home at a unusual time of day, and inevitably, and every time, the dog would know the owner's on the way and start rushing the door and, you know, getting agitated and waiting for the owner. They knew the owner was on the way. Now,
I don't know how to explain that except ESP.
Well, I don't either, but it may mean that animals do have some senses that go beyond ours, it would seem.
Well, in dogs in particular are very attuned to human behavior, incredibly attuned, domestic dogs. You know, there's an interesting study about the difference between domesticated dogs and wolves who have never been domesticated. What is the difference between a wolf and a dog in terms of our relationship with them? And
that's the only difference, I think.
Well, okay, but dogs, domesticated dogs, are used to paying much more attention to people, to people's moods, to
yes.
What. Yeah, and the one experiment that I remember was they placed a piece of meat in a way it was very difficult for the dog to get at, and they put a wolf in there, and the wolf just kept trying and trying and trying to get this meat, and couldn't get it. The dog would try a little bit, realize it couldn't get it, and would look at the person, kept looking at the person like, are you going to help me out here?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was really the difference is wolves are just not used to checking in on people.
Huh.
So I think that there is a very strong bond, and it is bizarre. I mean, I don't own a dog myself due to allergies, but I have seen them do extraordinary things and seem to be extraordinarily sensitive to human needs. And, you know, that we all know about seizure dogs, right? You've heard about dogs who, people who have epilepsy. They have special dogs who are able to sense before the person has a seizure and give the person a warning. And what this does is it allows the patient to get to a safe place, to turn off the engine, to pull off to the side, because they know a seizure is coming.
Okay. I could be wrong about this, but, you know, there was a Animal Act in Las Vegas that had a tragedy. You know about that?
You mean the tigers?
Yes.
Yes.
There's a story going around that tiger did not maul him just for nothing, that, in fact, he was having a stroke, and that the tiger, in an effort to protect him and get him off stage, grabbed him as it would one of its own around the neck and drag it off.
Well, I believe Siegfried and Roy themselves said that. They did not feel it was a mauling.
That's right.
Yeah, that something, well, whether it was he was having a stroke or there was a noise in the audience or something that made the tiger concerned about the trainer.
Well, they did say that, and I would think that could be perhaps backed up medically, or maybe not, you know, with all that happened, perhaps not, but...
Well, the one thing is that tiger could have killed him and didn't. I mean, it could have really ripped him apart, and what it did was it grabbed him and pulled him off the stage, as if it was trying to take it to a safe place. So
it could be a case of that.
It could be a case of that, and I don't believe the tiger has been destroyed. I think the tiger is still...
Right.
Yeah, in their family.
Okay. Oh, we've got a long list to get through here. You have this thing down. I had no idea there was such a disease as a perpetual fever?
Oh, peripheral fever.
Peripheral? Is that what it is, peripheral?
Puerperal fever. It's childbirth fever. But what is fascinating, the reason I bring this up is I've wanted to write a book about this subject for a long time.
Childhood fever.
Childbirth fever.
Birth fever.
Childbed
okay.
fever. It's really what Mary Shelley's, who wrote Frankenstein, what her own mother died of. And the reason I bring it up is it is such a horror story. It is, you know, we can't imagine what medicine was like in the 1800s.
All right, I'm not fully understanding what it is, so begin there.
Okay. It is death from a bacterial infection sometime between birth and 10 days postpartum. It's the death of the mother. And it's a fever that's caused by a variety of bacterial species, but they infect the genital tract, usually the uterus, and the infection spreads throughout their body, and they die, really, of sepsis. Now, today we treat it with antibiotics, but in those days they did not, and what was frightening about it was that it happened in hospitals. If you gave birth to a baby out in the street, you didn't get it. You went to a hospital, you got it. And it got to be so bad that I found statistics for late 1700s.
Yes.
One hospital in France, no woman survived childbirth that whole year. They all died of it. They all went into the hospital and died of it.
Oh, my God. I'd stay away from the whole hospital.
But it brings up, it brings to mind what the medical conditions were in those periods. What was happening was, of course, it was being spread by the doctors and the nurses. That's what was happening. There were no gloves there. So they would examine a woman who is in labor. They would go on to the next bed, examine the woman in labor without having washed their hands.
I see.
Clean, and go, and they were, you know, really sort of like death's agents. And 10 to 20% of women were dying after coming into hospitals. But it's the conditions of the hospitals that reawaken this sense of, oh my God, we've gone a long way. They would put women in hospital beds with the sheets that had not been changed since the previous people had died. So you'd be lying in a bed that's soaked with blood, dried blood,
or,
you know, all the secretions of childbirth. They would put four patients to a bed. They would die so quickly, they didn't have enough coffins. They were throwing several people into coffins at a time. There was a description in Hungary of a hospital where the women's lying-in area was in a ward, and on one end they could look out the window and see the cemetery, and on the other end of the ward they saw the dissecting room where all the autopsies were being done.
Huh, great atmosphere.
Yeah, a great atmosphere, exactly. So, and you know, things were dirty, and women, the reason women actually went into these hospitals is, number one, they maybe did not have enough money. The real reason, though, is that if you went into a hospital and you died there, your baby would be taken care of by the state. If you died at home, your baby was left to the elements. So, I mean, a lot of these women were concerned about what would happen to their children.
Well, under the circumstances, your chances sounded better at home.
Your chances sounded better at home. And you'd think that they would stay at home, but there were just large numbers of people who went into the hospitals essentially knowing that they were going to die, because they were giving birth to a baby.
Why, even at that time, doctor, would they not have considered the possibility of cross-contamination? Yes?
You would think so. And this is an example of how medicine sometimes has a total blind eye to the obvious. You would think so. The question was, why were these women dying? They didn't really have a good sense of what infection was caused by.
Right.
One of the ridiculous ideas was that, well, these women were dying because of their modesty had been violated by being examined by male doctors. That they were dying of, you know, just
embarrassment.
Can you
God,
believe it?
No.
But the other thing that happened was they were noticing that actually women were dying at a faster rate if they were examined by doctors as opposed to midwives.
Huh.
The wards in which the midwives were taking care of these people were not dying as quick. There were not as many not as high a mortality rate.
And what would the scientific reason for that be?
Well, this is something else that freaked me out when I read this. Medical students who were attending to these women, where would they hang out during the day? They had no lounge for doctors. They had no place for medical students to sort of sit around and spend the time. So where they would spend the time was the dissecting room. They would hang out there around these infected corpses.
Oh.
They would do their dissections, they would do the autopsies, they'd get totally covered in bacteria, and they would go straight to the wards without washing their hands. So this, you know, the doctors were the ones who were really spreading it, because they were hanging out with the corpses and the midwives were not. And they were all spreading infection.
I'll be damned.
Yeah, and to think about just how many bacteria they were carrying on their hands coming from the autopsy room. The really sad part was who the one man who really made a difference was a doctor named Dr. Ludwig Semmelweis. He was from Hungary, and he noticed that the midwives seemed to have a better rate of survival than the men, the doctors, and he began to wonder why. And didn't care about the so-called atmospheric conditions or noxious air idea that was killing women. He thought maybe it has something to do with the fact the doctors were spending all this time in the autopsy room. It also impressed him that one of his friends punctured a finger while he was taking care of a woman, and that friend died of essentially sepsis. And he thought, there's an infection going on. There's some kind of a bug that's being passed around. So all he did was tell everybody, wash your hands. He made everybody in this one hospital wash their hands. and the mortality rate dropped to 1/10 of what it used to be. And that, you'd think that was enough evidence to make doctors change their practice.
One would think.
It didn't. Doctors were so upset at the idea that they would have unclean hands. You know, they felt they were gentlemen. Doctors were gentlemen. And they did not want to be labeled as unclean. So they hounded Dr. Semmelweis out of his practice.
That's absolutely amazing.
He ended up in an insane asylum.
Oh my.
He was so devastated by the attacks, by the loss of his reputation, that he ended up in an institution where, ironically enough, he cut himself, and he died of sepsis, the very disease that he had been studying all those years.
He did not demand that whoever treated him go first, wash up?
Well, I think at that point in a mental institution, what can you demand? They do what they're going to do to you.
I suppose that's true. While we're on the category of things being passed like this, you know, I've been watching the headlines, Doctor, for some time now, about the possibility of a tiny little genetic change in this horrifying bird flu, and the possibility of it being, even some stories beginning to suggest they're seeing human-to-human transfer of this bird flu with a mortality rate through the roof. I mean, some incredible figure, like 55.
Yes, it is. It's somewhere between 30% and 70%.
Of the people who get it die, is what that means, folks. And I'm watching these stories very carefully, and they're kind of eerie, Doctor, because the stories sort of are saying it's not a matter of when or if, but rather when. In other words, it's going to happen.
We are overdue for a pandemic of the flu, and I don't think there's anybody who doubts that there is going to be one. Whether it is this particular one, we don't know.
Why do the scientists seem so damn convinced that this is the one? I mean, there are so many stories about it saying we're just, you know, a hair's breadth away from it. And why are they so convinced in this particular case? Do you have any idea?
Well, it's because it's already killed people. Part of the problem, of course, is that, you know, where its cradle is in Asia. It's
yes.
Because there's so much contact between people and birds.
Yes.
They live with their chickens and their ducks and their geese. And this is sort of like the perfect stew to get this virus to mutate. It doesn't take very much. It just takes one person being infected with the avian flu at the same time they are infected with a more common
flu.
Person-to-person flu.
And they somehow merge?
They exchange genetic material.
Yes.
And that what it does is it changes the bird flu into something that's more easily transmissible between people.
Like a sneeze.
Like a sneeze. And that's of course, what scares us all. And, you know, I've been worried about this for quite some time. I can't get to... It just seems to me that a lot of people are going around with their heads underwater, not caring about what's happening.
Tell you an interesting little secret. When you do an interview like this, there are a number of, you know, suggested, scripted interview questions that you can ask a guest. But some of the more interesting ones come not from there, but sort of just the thread of the conversation. And in this case, we've really stumbled into one here. When you hear a doctor, like Dr. Gerritsen, respond to a question about this, you know, possible bird flu thing by saying, I've got a family plan. You don't have to read between the lines there. You know, obviously, she takes this very, very seriously, as do I. And so, therefore, I'm most interested in what your family plan would be, Doctor.
Withdrawal from society, I'm afraid to say. We have a son in college right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we had told him that as soon as he gets the word from us, and you know, we watch the WHO bulletins, we watch what's happening in Asia, we are waiting to see human-to-human transmittal, and we told him that as soon as he hears from us, he has to leave school immediately.
And come home.
And we are expecting, you know, our nuclear family, at least, to be together. We have a certain amount of food put aside. We have wood to burn in case it's cold. And, you know, you have to accept the possibility that there will be no Public services like water, for instance. I mean, where's your water going to come from? Where's your power going to come from if those things shut down, if people don't show up for work?
We think very much alike.
Yeah, and luckily we have we do have a cottage that is on a lake so that we can always get water. We can always keep ourselves warm. The question is, are you going to have enough food to go for the 3 months it'll take to...
All right, that was going to be my next question. You're estimating... Three months, that could be a little optimistic, couldn't it?
It could be a little optimistic. It could go. And you know, the as you said, in 1918, the bird flu had several surges. There was one surge where people died, and then it seemed to go away, and then it came back again and killed even more people.
Huh.
So you may think that it's over with, but it actually is just sort of like taking a little breath, and it comes right back.
Right.
So I think that it's important for people to have that sense of, well, I have water, I have food, I have heat, I have shelter. Because you're not going to really want to be out in public. You're certainly not going to want your kids to go to school. It's going to take probably 6 months for them to manufacture enough of a vaccine so that in that particular time, a lot of people could die.
And it's going to be too late for millions. Millions and millions. And this could potentially spread so quickly that I'm with you. I've figured that the first time I see a legitimate human-to-human transmission, really, I've seen several such stories, and I'm sure you have too, Doctor, which may not be true. And I don't know how you're going to discern when you get the one that is true, because by then, by the time they really cop to it, it could be way too late.
Well, that's certainly possible. I think that what'll happen is it's going to break out somewhere in Asia.
Yes.
And news may not get to us right away, but before it actually gets on a plane and hops here, it'll probably spread within local villages, and that should give us enough of a chance to know. I mean, I've seen that the computer generated model of how long it would take to get to the United States. It's going to spread locally first. And so we're probably going to have, you know, days, weeks to know ahead of time when to be cautious, because those local villagers are not going to be getting on planes. It's going to be healthcare workers or tourists who are going to bring it home.
Doctor, is it like Ebola? Is it like a what is it like, this bird flu?
Oh,
if it does get loose, and what does it do?
What does it do? It turns, if you're young and healthy,
yes,
it can turn your own immune system against you. And that's the scary part about it. I mean, if you're older, it probably will kill you in the way that flus have killed in the past, which is turn into a bacterial pneumonia.
Right.
Or just kill you from a viral pneumonia. But what was frightening about the flu in 1918, which, by the way, started off as a bird flu then as well, it actually causes us to have what they call a cytokine storm. It makes our immune system turn against our own lungs and destroys lungs. And, you know, the descriptions from 1918 of the soldiers who died, the American soldiers who died, was that they would feel a little bit ill, and then a day later, 2 days later, they were coughing up blood and dead. And that was not necessarily the virus itself. It was actually the virus causing the body to come up with a very strong immune response.
So once your immune system is gone, anything gets you virtually.
Well, yeah, but in that particular case, it was actually the immune system causing damage to the lungs.
Well, we know something, I guess, about the way the people are dying, because there have been X number of victims of it already.
Yes.
If by direct, so that's the way they're dying, huh?
And you know,
and how quickly?
You know what? It does vary. It can happen within days. It may take longer because some of these people are being put on respirators, so they're lingering a while. But, you know, we're talking about hospitals being overwhelmed in the U.S. We don't have enough ventilators to keep everybody alive. So death could come very quickly if you don't have ventilatory support. You don't have enough doctors and nurses on the front lines. I think that the medical personnel, they're going to probably have access immediately to things like Tamiflu.
All right.
They will be protected.
Here's another one for you. This is so frightening. The prospect of this is so frightening that if we became aware that a certain province in China had, or the Chinese government became aware that a certain province in China had indeed, all the worst fears had come true. It had mutated. It was spreading from human to human. And it was 70% fatal. It was killing everything it came in contact with and fast. And this is all very conceivably possible. Do you think the Chinese government or whatever government would be in question here would consider the possibility of sanitizing the entire area where it's occurring with something like a nuclear weapon?
No, never.
No, never, huh?
I don't think they would do that.
You don't?
And even then, you have to ask yourself, it might have gotten out already.
Well, it might have. I'm just wondering if it came to that point of decision. And you know, as you point out, the computer models are quite specific about how quickly it would spread.
Yeah.
If they had that one moment in time when they could deal with it, would they?
I don't think there's a country on earth that would make that political decision. I just can't imagine it. So they can try quarantine, but they don't work. People will slip out. And the other thing you remember is that birds migrate. So, I mean, is it a possibility that actually birds may bring it around the world?
Is that a possibility? In other words, the human form of it, could they become somehow carriers of what would be this new human form?
Well, I'd be more concerned with people because people are closer in contact with people. But you have to ask yourself, if they can pass it to us, is it possible that we could pass on a version back to the birds? I think that it's more of a concern, air travel. Now, you live in a fairly isolated area, and I live in an area that's not on a common travel route, or we're up at sort of a mid-coast Maine.
Yes.
So I think that we would have a little bit more warning than, say, somebody in New York City or Los Angeles or San Francisco.
Perhaps so.
Yeah.
You think, again, that 3 months would be a reasonable effort to make at absolutely closing yourself off from the world, and I mean nobody.
I think that's a minimum. I think that's what you sort of should have enough food for, and that's not hard. I mean, enough rice and beans, you could stock that away and be careful with your food. As long as what you have water, I think that's in some areas of the country that's a tougher thing to have access to water.
And if you have all of those things, doctor, you also probably should have a gun.
Well, okay, that's a personal choice.
It's a personal choice, but for the kind of woman who writes the kind of books you do, if that didn't occur to you, I would be very shocked indeed.
I'm not going to talk about guns.
All right, that's fine.
I'm not going to even
that
say
also
whether I have
answers
one.
It just fine. Thank you.
Yeah.
Getting back to evil for a moment, Doc.
Yes.
I interviewed a great man named Father Malachi Martin. He was very close to two popes. He was a very fascinating, very deep, very believable man.
He's done exorcisms, hasn't he?
Oh, you betcha.
Yeah.
And he believed deeply, completely, absolutely in the presence of real evil. And I mean the real McCoy evil.
Yes.
And he suggests that it is far more widespread than you can possibly believe, that many people walking down the street that you meet every single day and go by you on the street have made silent deals with the devil. He called it perfect possession.
Mm-hmm.
And so what about that brand of evil, doctor? Do you go that far with it?
I believe, I'm not sure I believe in Satan, but I certainly believe that evil exists. And it's interesting because it's actually the topic of the book that I'm working on now. About
evil as a manner of behavior, doctor?
No,
or evil,
Satan.
Evil at
Satan.
That one.
Whether or not, who is Satan? What has been our impression of Satan over the centuries? Who is he, and whether or not this is what the explanation is for evil. I don't believe in, as I said, I'm an agnostic on all issues, particularly this.
Including Satan.
Including Satan. Well, but, if you're going to believe in God, you're going to have to believe in, if you're going to believe in the light, you're going to have to believe in the dark, right?
Well, I almost thought for a second there you were declaring a belief in Satan. It almost sounded that way, and I was going to spring it on you. Can't be.
No, I think I'm looking at it just from a curiosity, scholarly point of view, just because... if you're interested in good, you also have to be interested in evil and how it has been viewed through the years. And frankly, the biblical view, or the the ecclesiastical view of Satan has, and he's gotten a bad rap in some ways. I think that you go back to what is the meaning of Lucifer? How do you translate that word? It means the bringer of light, knowledge.
A bad rap.
It's because of the way. What who is Lucifer? Who is the snake? What did the snake do that was so wrong?
Yes.
It opened Eve's eyes. So a lot of what our view of Satan is has to do with the fact that the church, through the centuries, has not been happy with people asking questions.
Huh. Well, you talk with much more animation about Lucifer than you do about God.
It's because Lucifer is a very...
dark.
No, well, it's not just dark. I think it's a very controversial topic, and it fascinates me. I don't believe he exists, but I like to look into what people have considered to be satanic, or where is the background of Lucifer. But when we're talking about evil, I think of evil as being something completely different. To me, evil is causing human misery. That's what evil is. Whether you want to say it's caused by Satan or whether it's caused by people being bad. As far as your friend, my own feeling is that we carry evil within ourselves, that people are capable of worse things than we could ever imagine. Because I write crime thrillers now, I encounter people sometimes who really kind of freak me out. I was on book tour once, and this was for the book The Surgeon, which is about a serial killer who does what Jack the Ripper once did. He cuts women open and removes their sexual organs and gets a great deal of pleasure out of this particular practice of his. So I'm sitting there signing books, and a very ordinary, nice-looking man comes up and bends over, and he whispers in my ear. He says, "Thank you for writing this book." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "You allowed me to indulge in my fantasies."
Oh, my God.
And then he took a signed book, and he walked out. And I thought, how many people are walking the streets with these fantasies? Now, I'm not saying that he did anything wrong, but my feeling is that there are a lot of people who have.
Yeah, but you had to imagine that as a possibility.
Yes, who think about these things, who enjoy these things, who maybe love to fantasize about these, but never actually act on their impulses. So luckily, most human beings are able to put a clamp down on the inappropriate things they know they could do. What is scary, though, is when you get into a situation such as after the bird flu, or when civilization breaks down, or when there are no police forces, and then these crazy people, not necessarily crazy people, but evil people, feel
yes.
free to do what they want to do.
Yes.
And that's why, you talk about guns. I can understand the logic of having one, yes.
Well, if you have all the other things you named, you're going to need a gun.
To keep your family safe.
Yes. As quickly as the bird flu would spread, I think that man beginning to cross that line between fantasy and action would be even faster.
Well, desperation leads people to do some pretty horrible things. You're taking care of your family. Well, that man over there is taking care of his family, too. And if it involves getting rid of you, then he'll do it.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Regarding evil, from a scientific point of view, do you think that it is hereditary? Do you think it is passed from father to son, or skips generations like some other things, that evil is inherited, it's just in the genes?
There are some really kind of disturbing cases of families who do stuff together. and I think we talked about this once before. There was a case in Oregon of a young man who called up the police and said, my dad raped my girlfriend, and by the way, I think my dad is capable of some worse things. And they dug up the father's backyard and found some dead girls. Apparently, he had been a serial killer. He'd been killing girls in the neighborhood. Yes, and so this came out in the news, and then what followed up was interesting, was that this serial killer's father was in jail at that moment for having killed girls and burying them in exactly the same way. So here you are, this young man, your father is a serial killer, your grandfather is a serial killer. It's got to make you wonder about whether or not there's any genetic stuff going on.
Well, do you wonder hard about that?
Well, there are cases of people who, there is a Dutch family who apparently every male in that family had been in prison, and it appeared to be a genetic defect.
God, I mean, you know, you mentioned about the killing the women in that certain horrible way and then burying the bodies, and grandfather and father and son. I mean, just that much alone, it would seem the odds against that, they could probably do that, work that up in a computer someplace and find the odds, but they'd be so astronomical that
they would be. That's right. But, you know, was it childhood influence, or was it genetics? That's hard to tease apart, except for that one Dutch family. And we just go back through the centuries. You can find families that they make their living off, you know, being predators. There's a whole Scottish family. It's called the Sawney Bean family. I think it was back in the 1500s. They would get people who were traveling. The family would just descend on these people, would drag them back to their cave in Scotland. It was like on the seashore, so at high tide you could not see the mouth of the cave. And there were, I believe, like 70 members of this family living there. And they would rob these travelers, and then they would take them back and eat them. So they were not. They would eat them. And
oh my God.
It was just the most feral kind of creatures you could imagine. And what ended up happening was they set upon one couple, and there were other people who were traveling the road and were able to fight them off. And the authorities sent soldiers out. They realized we have a real problem here. You know, there were people disappearing constantly in this part of Scotland.
Yes.
And they located the cave. They went into the cave, and they found thousands of human body parts.
Thousands?
Yes. Things had been eaten, bones, leftover remains, and they found these people, and they dragged out the whole family, and they were all executed. Pretty quickly. I think it was clear to them that they were dealing with a family of monsters. But, that was the 1500s.
That's
then you get
horrible
America.
That's
America has them.
All right.